I work in El Salvador right now under the sponsorship of the Mennonite Central Committee and the United Church of Christ, and I'm specifically assigned to the Baptist churches of El Salvador. And for the last 2.5 years, my work has specifically been focused primarily on the whole issue of forced military service. And I work with a program that was begun by Baptist young people to in some way respond to that whole issue. So today, what we want to do is focus very specifically on what that is, try to give you a feel of those kinds of issues and some of the things that are being done about them by Salvadorans themselves. For those of you who were not in our session yesterday, let me just begin by way of a very, very brief introduction. Most people probably know that there is a war going on in El Salvador. There's been a civil war there for about 11 years, a full-fledged war. The FMLN is the guerrilla group who are fighting to try to overthrow the government of El Salvador, a government that is heavily supported by the United States government. Their sessions that I'm doing this week, yesterday was more of an introduction with some of the history. I'm going to do this today. On Thursday, we'll look more specifically at what the U.S. interest and U.S. role in El Salvador is. Why is the U.S. there? What do our tax dollars pay for? And then finally, on Friday, we'll focus more on the church and what the role of the church is there, but more specifically, what is our role as North Americans in responding to that situation. Okay, to begin the whole session on what usually is referred to as forced military recruitment because of the way it's translated from Spanish. And at first I didn't like that, but now I think it's probably better because we tend to think of a draft as being a system, and there is no system as we'll see today. So I'm going to refer to it as forced military recruitment, even though recruitment sounds like you might have a choice. And we're going to begin. I have recruited this is the Holden Repertoire Theater here, and we're going to begin the session today with a little skit. So, you guys want to go out first? So imagine that you're in El Salvador. This is going to represent a bus, as you'll see in a minute, and we'll take it from there. Not quite yet. All right, we're ready.
San Miguel, San Miguel, all aboard for San Miguel.
Okay, so you can start. Most buses in El Salvador have some music system.
Beep, 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 beep.
Excuse the interruption today, but as you all know, it's a tough situation in this country. In order for us to protect you from the terrorists that are fighting us, we do need to take these kind of procedures. So I'd like to ask all the men, please, to get off the bus. This won't take very long if you cooperate with us. Women, you can stay where you are. Please line up against the bus side there. Spread your hands, legs. Check their papers, please.
Papers.
You can get back on the bus. Ever been in the service before?
No.
Well, this is your lucky day. Looks like you might be a pretty good soldier there.
Can you take my son, please?
Why don't you step right over here?
He's the oldest in our family. You can't take him. He's the only one who makes money in our family.
Hey, that's the way it is for everyone in this country. I'm sorry. What do you think? I was the oldest one in my family, too, and they took me.
But we need him. What are we going to do without him?
look, everyone's in the same boat. You know, we need soldiers. We got to protect this country. If we let the communists take over this place, then, you know, what's it going to be for anyone?
What if he gets killed or injured or something?
But that's part of the risk. Besides that, he's going to be making money. He can send money back to you. Sorry. Next. What do the rest of them look? You haven't served either, no? How old are you?
16.
Well, that doesn't matter. Okay. All right, why don't you step on over here with
me?
No,
you can't take me. My little sister, she's hurt, and I'm taking her to the doctor in San Miguel, and she's so little, she can't be alone on the bus.
Going to the doctor now. Yeah, everybody's got some story.
Wait, you can't leave this little girl on my bus.
Is she really by herself? There's no other family member?
No.
All right, fine. We'll take her, too. Come on. We'll take care of this later. Maybe somebody can pick you up. But you're not going to get out of this for this. You know, we need everybody. I have a quota today. I got to get 20 people before we can go home. This is a good start. Looks like somebody else here.
Looks like a real good
lab.
Yeah. You want to just make sure that they don't get away there. Keep them under guard. Okay. You haven't served either, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want you to step on up
with
the rest of
them. I'm a Christian. And I believe that God thinks this war is evil, and I don't want
it. Hey, I don't like fighting this war. I'm a Christian, too.
And plus, I got
I grew up in the church.
Listen, plus I got a wife and 5 children at home. And I put 5 in.
5 children?
Yeah.
How old are you?
I'm 35.
35? You don't look that old. Your schedule says you're only 26, so you're still within the age. You know, just step on over here. Look, I mean, I got a wife and 2 kids, too, you know? I mean, we're all in the same thing together, so. Okay, let's see here. 1, 2. Hey,
no!
Stop him! Okay, that's the end. Stay in the bus if you want to, or you can sit in other chairs. Or somebody might want to go to sleep. That's a very, very common scene in El Salvador, and the specific cases are ones that have really happened. There really have been cases that I know of where a little sister was taken with her older brother. Obviously they'd make you serve in the military, and eventually, because the commanding officer was so aggravated by the stupidity of the person who had taken them, that they let him go too. But they actually did take, there have been people shot while trying to run. And it happens all the time that mothers and sisters and family members come begging. Anytime there's been a recruitment campaign or a drive, which happens every, they do it, different groups in the military do it for 3 days at a time, you will see lines of mothers at the gates of military bases in El Salvador. Let me just go through some basic explanation and tell you some more stories related to the whole situation of the draft system, if there is such a system. As you saw, the bus is probably the best, quote-unquote, recruitment place. It also happens in parks, in festivals. Very often, if there are parties or celebrations where they know there are going to be a lot of young people, the Army will come in and take people from there. Any place where there are high concentrations of young people. In one case, we even know that they waited outside of a high school until students came out. And the ones in uniforms, most schools in El Salvador have to wear uniforms, and they took the oldest of the young men. As you also saw, there's no notification system. If a family member's not on the bus, if somebody's young man's by himself, the family just simply will know that they didn't come home. They don't know where they are. We have spent several cases up to a week just looking for somebody, trying to figure out where they are. It's an ironic situation because families start hoping that they've been recruited because the other alternatives are worse, that perhaps they've been killed or assassinated. It is I'm a person who very seldom says never. But in this case, I can say never is recruitment done in wealthy sections of El Salvador. It happened one time about 5 years ago when President Duarte ordered that, because he's getting a lot of pressure about this, and so they recruited a bunch of people in a nightclub area of San Salvador where only the wealthy could afford to go. And by the next morning, all of them had been released because of pressure from parents and connections, and you know, everybody's gonna know somebody who's an officer in the military. That's the only time that I know that's ever happened. And it's primarily done on public buses. Wealthy people and middle class people don't ride public buses for the most part. If you're in a private vehicle, you're never stopped to recruit. There are very few volunteers in the Salvadoran Army in the enlisted ranks. And in fact, there are cases known where people have volunteered have been immediately suspected of being infiltrators and been arrested, because the assumption is that no one would want to volunteer. I have a picture here, and I'll pass this around. This appeared in La Prensa Gráfica, which is one of the largest newspaper in El Salvador, very conservative, very, very much sort of propaganda for the government. And it has this picture, and it says, volunteers. It says, youth coming from various parts of the Department of Cuscatlan present themselves to the military detachment, asking that they be incorporated voluntarily into the armed forces. Well, everybody just looks at this and laughs. I mean, there is no way that this many people, there's about 50 people in there, would have volunteered. Unless they basically came into town and said, you can volunteer or we'll recruit you. I mean, that's what sometimes happens. I can just pass that around. Sometimes after people are recruited, in terms of, is there any option of getting out on your own? Almost none. Sometimes there have been officers who have come into a group of new draftees and said, who doesn't want to be here? Well, it's a catch-22, or it's a real trick, because sometimes there have been cases where somebody's raised their hand and they've let them go. But most of the time what happens is, if you raise your hand, then your treatment is worse than everyone else's. You're just beaten. And so people who know that, nobody raises their hand. So then it's a way of saying, okay, everyone wants to be here. Obviously, you all really want to serve your patria, your country. Just to give you some of the legal context of all this, the Constitution of El Salvador says that military service is obligatory for 18 to 30-year-olds for 2 years. It also says right under that that there will be a law to regulate this. There is no such law. There has not been one since the new constitution was written in 1983. So everything is either legal or illegal, depending on which way you want to look at it. But lawyers are in a situation where they say, there's nothing we can do legally. There is no legal grounds on which we can go and do anything about this in the country. And basically the military is going to do what they want to anyway. There has been pressure about it. About in September of last year, the armed forces came out with a major announcement saying, we're going to reform the system. We're no longer going to take people off of buses. We're going to send people notices and have them report to us in 2 or 3 days. We're not going to do anything at night. A whole series of things they promised to do. Absolutely nothing has changed. Not a thing. And it's been almost a year. And in fact, the largest recruitment drive ever in El Salvador took place in December and January of this past year. Let me tell you just a couple quick stories of cases that we have dealt with. One was one that I mentioned very briefly yesterday, who was a young man who was 29 and a half, so he only had half a year left before he would technically not been eligible anyway. He had two young daughters, a wife. He was the only one that earned income. He was recruited. He did sort of put up some sort of subtle resistance and was eventually hit in the head, had a concussion, and then did finally desert after all effort to get him out failed. There's a case of a young man who had a serious eye problem, and I asked him once we finally did get to them if they'd given him an exam, and he said, well, they just lined us up and sort of looked at us. There were no instruments and whatever, and he told people that he had this. He has a problem in which if he's out in the sun at all, he gets dizzy and sometimes faints and gets severe headaches. Well, it's not the kind of disability you can live with in the Army in El Salvador. We went to the training base where he was, had medical doctor's report saying that he had this problem, and all we did was ask that the base doctor examine him. That's all we wanted to say. Look, we know he's got a problem, just get the doctor to examine him. And they refused at first. The social worker at the gate said, well, look, he'll get out of here in 6 weeks with a pass. Maybe you can take him to a doctor then. And we said, look, this is a serious problem. The guy could really get hurt very seriously. So finally, we pulled a few strings with a European consulate. There's no way the U.S. Embassy would have helped us, but fortunately through somebody who asked us never to say that he had done this, one of the European consulates just simply made a phone call that said he knew we were coming. And immediately the colonel said he would see us. So we were ushered into the colonel's office, and he wanted to know what he could do for us. Well, the interesting thing was is that he was in a meeting at that time, and we walked into the office. We were introduced to the colonel, to a Salvadoran officer, and to the U.S. military advisor. And so it's just another way. There are two military advisors who are at that base, who are all part of designing the whole training procedures that they use. And we'll get in a minute to the kind of indoctrination stuff that goes on in that base, and I know goes on, and I know the military advisors have to know about it.
When they took the young man off the bus and they asked for their papers, what were they looking for in the papers?
Everyone in El Salvador has to have what's called a sedula. It's identification paper. And basically, it's a lot of it's just routine to see if you have them. First of all, that gets into a whole other issue, because a lot of the refugees who have come back, as well as people who have lived in parts of the country and been displaced, don't have those, because their towns are no longer, they've been burned, the record, they've lost them, and then the records in their place of birth have been burned. There's no records for them anymore. Or they can't go back to where it would be too dangerous for them to return to their hometown. They're displaced, and for them to go through would be too dangerous. So there are a lot of people that don't have them, and they really hassle people that don't have them. They're also looking for things. You get a card with your papers that says you've served in the military, if you have, and so therefore they're looking for those kinds of things. But it's also just a lot of it's just a procedure, because frankly, it's really pretty sad, but a lot of soldiers can't read and write. So you'll see somebody, I mean, I've had them check my papers before looking at it upside down.
All the people checking the papers can't read.
Right. I mean, but they're acting like they know what they're doing, but they can't read.
Well, what if you had a card that did prove that you had served your required 2 years? Does that...
They wouldn't take you. Yeah. For the most, I don't know of any cases where they made somebody. Yeah.
And they also said, like, when one of them was taking it, that they didn't have money sent back. When they go in the military, do they get money for that? Is that like
they
a
do
job?
Get paid, yes. And in fact, that's one of the things, I'll come back to that a little bit more, but just to say that they do receive a salary, and that's one of the main incentives for people staying in. There are not very many people who volunteer for that reason. There are some.
And then yesterday when you said that there's a certain amount that are employed, is that a large amount of people that are employed, people that are in the military then? Or is that not counted?
That's a really good question. I assume that the employment figures include this military in that. I assume that's true. I'll come back to the whole money thing, because I could tell story after story of looking for people, of having good luck on some days where we showed up at a gate and the officer just decided, oh, I was a Baptist once 10 years ago. I'll do something good today. Come back in 2 hours and I'll let him go. And he did. It was totally shocked. We've never had that happen before. But he just decided, all right, you guys look like you're, you know, we just try to look very meek and mild, like we're good pastors. And he let him go. I used to have a beard, and I shave my beard so I look more conservative when I go up to the military bases. Okay, so let me just say a couple more things, and then I want to show you just a clip out of a video. Obviously, this kind of system is a daily factor for young men in El Salvador. It influences whether or not you're going to get on a bus. Most people live in an area where there's probably not going to be jobs, so if you want to take a bus from your little town, even if you only live close by, into the city to look for work, you run the risk every day of getting on a bus and being stopped and recruited. There are certain times of the month, or every 2 weeks, so to speak, that the military is known to do more recruiting. So therefore, word gets around usually, and usually it's at the ends of the month, in the middle of the month, so young men won't come get on buses. Well, that directly affects, for instance, church programs. I mean, if we plan an event, a regional event, say in the eastern part of El Salvador for a workshop, we try not to do it at the end of the month because it'll be all women. It's usually up mostly women anyway, because in churches, and actually most places in El Salvador, there are more women than men. The men are either fighting on one side or another, they're dead, they've abandoned their families, or they've left the country because they're fleeing one or another. I mean, that's obviously, there are a lot of men in the country, but there, and you find in Baptist churches and most churches that, especially among the young people, that there are many more women than men. There are a lot of reasons for that, but those are some of them. It's the kind of thing where, and that really is a situation that prompted Baptist young people initially to try to take some action, was finally realizing that, you know, we cannot just sit back and not do anything about this. This affects us daily, our daily lives. And we don't feel like as Christians that we can sit back and do nothing about it. Okay. I think the only thing that I think that I've missed here is just to have mentioned that there was a proposal in 1987 for a law that would have regulated the draft, which would have had would have been incorporated a system of a lottery. It did actually have a provision for conscientious objection in peacetime, which I always found interesting. I mean, what good conscientious objection do in peacetime? But anyway, it seemed at least some kind of recognition of the problem. If it really had been followed to the letter of the law, it would have made it non-discriminatory, at least. In other words, people of all classes would have had to participate. Of course, whether or not it would have been another problem. But it never even got a vote on the floor of the assembly. Why? Because the people, primarily in the assembly, are ones that don't want their sons having to face that. So that's why, even though the Constitution requires a law, there has never been one passed, because the elite, who tend to be the ones in the assembly, don't want one. The way it is now, you can just sort of keep it nice and unsystematic and recruit the poor. Finally, the question always comes up, and I think it's a really important one, is does the FMLN do this kind of stuff? We primarily work on issues related to the Army and the Air Force, the government forces recruiting. The answer is, yes, they do sometimes, but not anywhere near the same degree. And there have been cases, more recently, it seems to be happening more. As negotiations are going on and there's more leverage being put militarily by both sides on things, so that negotiators will have more leverage at the peace talks. Most of the time, though, I mean, I think I don't want to try in any way to be an apologist for the FMLN, I do think that the distinction is an important one. I do know one case where people were forcibly recruited out of a few communities in a department called Chalatenango, and because that happened, the person in charge was demoted by the FMLN. They said, this is not what we do. And he was demoted specifically because he went out and forcibly recruited people and just sort of took people out of the village. What normally happens with the FMLN, which isn't necessarily any better, is that they do give people a choice. They will say, you are in a liberated zone, you are in a zone more or less controlled by the FMLN. This is your country, you have an obligation to fight to defend it. And so therefore you need to incorporate into our ranks or leave. And usually that choice is given, but it's still a choice that does make it necessary for people to leave their homes. So it does, it's an issue in which people become victims on both sides, but more so for the government.
What percentage of people in FMLN-controlled territory are sympathetic with the FMLN, agree with their goals?
You know, that's a question that is often asked, and I don't know if anybody, in the FMLN-controlled areas, I would say it's extremely high. I mean, people who have some kind of sympathy would be well over 50%. I would say probably 60, 70%. And then there's all different levels of support. There are people who are not combatants, but support through logistical things and supplies and, you know, women who make tortillas day after day after day for the soldier, for the troops and things like that. And other people who wouldn't necessarily participate directly, very often, the FMLN does sort of come into town and say, we need this kind of help, you know, come on. And there's not a whole lot of choice involved in that. It might be just carrying something. It might be carrying a wounded person for a few miles until they get to another village. There would be some people who would do that very willingly and see that as part of their sort of solidarity with all the stuff going on, and other people who would not like it at all and feel victimized by both sides.
Was that basically economic reasons why they're supporting, or for their life?
In other words, they wouldn't be supportive if
they aren't supported, they get shot, or yeah, they get paid for what they have.
The people I'm talking about who would be sympathetic would be people who would do it out of their own motivations and without a fear. I mean, there are certainly people who this is the same. I mean, some people would fear not doing that kind of thing if they were asked to do a particular task because of the consequences that might come. But for the most part, I mean, there are huge numbers of people, and I think this is what people have to deal with, who really do support the FMLN, or at least, or somehow or another, or share the same goals, even if they don't share the same meaning. And it's because of the situation in the country. I mean, they really do want some kind of change. And they see that some kind of active movement, whether it's an armed movement or a nonviolent movement, is necessary to do that. Let me just show you a clip. If you want it, this is only about 4 minutes, but it shows some actual footage of people who were recruited and the first few days that they're in. This is after they would have been taken off of a bus. And the main thing I want to ask you to really concentrate on is just look at the faces of the young men, and especially compare their faces at the beginning and then the last shot when they're on a truck.
Is this a video produced by the Army, or is it produced by?
No, this was it comes out of an hour-long video called Stories from El Salvador that was produced by some British filmmakers and was shown on PBS sometime last year. We're just going to see one clip out of it.
Do you know how that footage was shot? Do you have permission to do that?
They had to have had permission to do it because they were inside the base barbershop and all that. And that's probably why they didn't have footage of any kind of actual recruitment, you know, taking place where they actually drag people off of buses. But somehow or another they got permission. I don't know.
Cleaned up the rack.
How to do it. I mean, there is some remarkable footage that comes out from filming.
The end of this little clip made it sound like a majority of the campesinos who are recruited are given enough status and enough money or whatever to improve their lifestyle. They want to stay in the Army. Is that a true statement or is that...
Well, that's exactly what I want to talk about right now. There's a few more things I want to say and then we'll save some time for more questions. I like having questions as we go too, like we're doing. What did you, do you see a difference between the faces at the beginning and the end? What strikes you?
They've bought in. Mm-hmm. They've bought into it.
There's a real sense of sort of macho sort of pride about being there. I mean, you can see, you know, several times I've been waiting inside a base to talk to somebody, whatever, and you can tell, especially in the training center, I've been there on visiting day, and you can tell who's been there for a week and who's been there for 2 months and is almost ready to get out. The ones that have been there for a week are just sort of looking at the ground and have very long faces, usually have uniforms that don't quite fit. They don't get rifles yet. They're usually alone or in groups of one or two. The ones that have been there longer have snappier uniforms, they have M16s, and they're walking around in groups of four, five, six, clearly telling jokes, laughing, and really have sort of a swagger about them. The Army does an incredible job of indoctrination. That doesn't mean it works for everyone. Desertion rate is extremely high. We'll talk about that in just a second. But one of the first people they interviewed in this talks about how they didn't allow them to sleep at night. So you people ask, well, why in the world, if you're forcibly recruiting people and you want them to fight for you, do you treat them like that? Well, what happens is that the first few weeks or first week or two they're in fact, the first couple of days, very often, they're denied sleep. They're made to stand for 30. We had one guy who had to stand for 36 hours without sleep, no food or water. There's stories about how they, let me just finish this part and I'll take it, how they make people eat vulture soup, for instance, or go out and round up stray dogs and that's what they cook for dinner. They're often beaten. There's just all sorts of an abuse. When I first explained this to a child psychologist who was visiting El Salvador with the human rights, the children's rights group, he said, it's exactly like the psychology of hostage taking. It's the Patty Hearst syndrome. Is that you break someone down physically and mentally to the point where when you start treating them a little bit better, they identify with you. And so what happens is that after a couple weeks, they get new uniforms, they get guns, the language of their training officer changes. They start joking around with them instead of just sort of, you know, denigrating them all the time. They start sort of becoming their buddies instead of just shouting them at them all the time. And it works for a lot of people. There are stories, I know of one particular case of a guy who was the sort of leader in his church and very much opposed to the military, and he got recruited. And there were efforts for the first couple months to get him out. And finally, by the third month, he said, no, I'm ready to stay. And he'd come back to his village on his leaves and just was a completely different person. The concern about it, what happens when you have a society where you have that many people who've gone through the military system. And in fact, we don't have sort of general statistics, but we know in one case in a prison where out of 235 male prisoners, 220 of them were ex-military. They were in there for, this isn't political prisoners, these are common criminals. You know, that's not in itself a final study. You were going to ask?
I was just going to ask if Isn't that the same basic philosophy that our military uses? Not so harsh, but how the first year you have to be very subservient and degraded. And
And U.S. military advisors are clearly involved in the whole thing. Yeah, you're right, it's a good point. It's no different. It's a little, yeah, the abuse is a little different, but it's the same kind of thing. An interesting comment from a fellow worker, North American worker, who had a little town, used to have conversations with, there are a lot of soldiers in town, and he would ask them, he was a pastor there, to talk a little bit about, he just, you know, conversation, well, you're members of the church, or are you Christian, whatever, and they would, he said there's only one case where a guy told him that he was. Everyone else said, I used to be. And some would say, maybe I will be after I'm out of the army. There was some sense in which they had been broken down so much, but they still recognized that morally they could not reconcile being Christian or a church person and being in Salvadoran Army, knowing what it did and what they had to do. There are also stories about how very often when human rights violations have occurred and people have been assassinated by the army, that they make the newest recruits do it. Because once you have done it, you've lost your moral integrity and it's much easier to do it again. So soldiers, it's also really important to remember that the soldiers in this skit who were pulling these people off a year before were the ones on the bus. And it's real hard for us to remember that sometimes because you get treated by the military the way you do, but the ones that have gotten stuck there are the victims of a year recruitment drive earlier. And so there's a whole way in which people are victimized. I won't talk about some of it. Some of it also has to do with the fact that it's hard sometimes for them to return home in certain parts of the country, at least, where the army is specifically a very, very much hated. So there's a whole victimization that goes on at various levels. Yeah.
Do you talk to the young men before they're recruited about things like that, about the idea that once you kill someone, you're going to become, I mean, there's a tendency for you to lose. I mean, do you suggest resistance, or how do you deal with that?
Well, so far the questions have come exactly at the timing that I was moving into there. let me mention one quick thing, and then that's exactly what I was going to do the next two. Just to end this sort of part and then talk a little bit about response, is just to say that obviously all of this victimization, all of this forced recruitment is part of a whole repressive system that keeps the military strong. It's a system in which the poor, literally, the poor fight to protect the land interest and the resource interest of the more wealthy. The officers are almost all from middle and upper class families, a little less so now than before. But, you know, they go to military school and they get that. And just the last thing I would say is the U.S., we have to understand how the U.S. is involved in that. One very quick story, a delegation was talking to Carlos Mejia, who is a U.S. Human rights officer in the U.S. Embassy in El Salvador. And at the end of the time, they were asking questions, and some of them asked about forced recruitment. And he said, well, it really doesn't exist. That's a myth. Well, anybody who lives there knows that it exists. So a couple of them had said, look, we were just on a bus the other day, and they stopped the bus, and they took young men off, and they said they were going to take them in the army. And when we know this happens, how can you say it doesn't happen? So they pressured him, and finally he said, okay, okay, okay. And then he said, but how else do you expect them to get their recruits? This is not only a U.S. Embassy personnel person, this is the person responsible for monitoring human rights and gets the reports back to Congress to see whether or not human rights are improving in El Salvador. That's his attitude. Okay, let's end with a few minutes on the alternatives, and then we can have some further questions. The Center for Youth Protection, and I have a whole bunch of these newsletters that were written about a year ago, but they're more of a sort of introduction to the program, so I'll let you each take one of those. and it has another article on some of the stuff we talked about. But it was a program started by Baptist young people, mostly in their 20s, about 3 years ago. I started working with the program about 2.5 years ago. And the program now has, we now work ecumenically with people from the Lutheran Church, Catholic-based communities, some from the Episcopal Church. And we do that kind of thing. We do everything from trying to respond to specific cases, where sometimes we can get somebody out. We try not to make that the number one priority, because our feeling is that if we just go around and get a few people out, what good have we really done? So we do have workshops that do everything from just helping people understand what the system is and how they might avoid getting recruited to start with. And we started with that, and we talked a little bit about some of the kinds of concerns you talked about. And now we've moved into more of doing things specifically on conscientious objection and trying to introduce that kind of idea. It's a UN basic human right now. As of 1989, it's recognized as a UN as a basic human right. El Salvador is a signer of those documents. So we approach it from that angle. We approach it very much from a theological and faith orientation, and try to sort of develop the concept of conscientious objection within a Salvadoran context. I mean, I'm not going around doing workshops on CO. It's Salvadorans that are working with me on that. It's not, you can't just take a European, North American concept and plop it down in El Salvador. We could talk more about what those differences mean. So that's where we really see the alternative. The alternatives in very specific cases are using connections to get someone out, persistence. There's a great story in here about a father who just refused to give up, and he basically camped out in front of the army gates until they got so fed up with him they let his son go. And there are exemptions that the armed forces recognize if you pressure them to, but they won't do it on their own. In other words, if you're an only son, for instance, if you're a student, if you're married now sometimes. But most campesinos aren't married because they can't afford to be. They're not legally married. Most Salvadorans are not legally married. They live in a marriage relationship and they live committed to each other and they're married. But they don't go through the church ceremony because the expectations are such that it costs them too much. So that doesn't work for most campesinos. So there are things that we can appeal to, and we can go through a process through military headquarters, and we can sometimes get people out based on those things. But the long, and desertion. Desertion is a major form of, for some people, I think you can call it conscious objection. They desert, and it's very, very high. But people then often leave the country, whatever. But for the long run, we see the primary alternative is creating a movement of resistance and conscientious objection. Perhaps at some point finally getting a law passed that might actually change some of this, but it has to be done where there really is a guarantee the law is going to be fulfilled. And that's obviously very risky, and it's not like we're anywhere close to having a movement of people who can be right out there and absolutely refusing to serve. But that's the kinds of things that are going on. There are some things that listed in here that people can help with in terms of supporting this program. There's also some stuff here that I'll hand out that has to do with an urgent action alert network that also responds to recruitment cases. Okay, why don't, there's more about any of this stuff that I can talk about, but that lays it out, and then we can spend the last few minutes going in whichever direction you folks want. Is there, okay, Bo? All right, I'll take you and then Nancy. Let's just make sure that no one...
The wealthy people of El Salvador, do any of those support like groups like yours? Are there like any that might happen to you?
There are some middle class people. I mean, it's not a very small, very large middle class in El Salvador, but there are middle... In fact, a number of the people involved in our program are university students. Mm-hmm. And... it's not always true, but for the most part, university students are going to be at least middle class. And they're very involved. I mean, there are people who, in Spanish would be consciente, or people who are aware of what's going on in the country. and are some way or another actively involved in maybe trying to change things. We don't have any really wealthy people that are involved.
So most of them just try to stay away from that?
Yeah, well, we'd like them to stay away. I think get too close and it affects our risk factor. Nancy?
I have two different questions. One is, you mentioned several times about desertion.
Mm-hmm.
What are the consequences if people desert? How does that affect the rest of their lives?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because it can be really two extremes. We've had two cases where two people deserted from one military detachment where they do their own training and they're not sent to the military training base. And they were severely treated. I mean, one guy almost died from the beating that he got. There was a case several years ago where a guy deserted from this same place and the commanding officer sent a detachment out. They found him in his home and they shot him on sight and killed him. So that's one level. In the middle is the judicial process basically says that in times of peace, I think the maximum sentence is 2 years, and in times of war, it's something like 12 to 15 years. But some lawyers say, well, the big question is here, are we technically at a war? Because the way the law defines war is more in terms of international conflict. What often happens, though, for the training center is, we had one sergeant there who happened to be a boyhood friend of the guy that I was with, who talked about all sorts of stuff. And he said that they're usually there for 3 months. After 6 weeks, they get their first pass. And he said 50% of the people don't come back.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've stopped giving those passes now for the most part. But he said, there's no way we can go track down all those people. What the risk is that an informant in your community would inform the military that you've come back. So there still is risk involved. So that's why people often go to different places. They go to a relative's house or they leave the country. But very often in those cases where somebody is found, they're beaten, they're maybe spent a week or so and locked up, and then if they agree to continue the military service, they'll let them do it. That's happened.
So it's sort of just if they can manage to hide out or whatever, then it might be okay, but they might get rounded up again at the next.
Well, see, that's the other thing. Yeah, I mean, they could easily be recruited again. I mean, we've had people, this same guy that I talked about had the eye disability. We asked him, can you give him some papers right now when he's leaving that says that he's disabled? No. So 3 weeks later, he was picked up again. We got him out again, but... And deserters, yeah, they always face that. A lot of deserters are in the United States. I mean, a lot of people who leave, and there's now been, it's a whole other thing, but just to mention, there's been a court case in the United States where conscientious objectors, or asylum was granted to Salvadorans based on the fact that they did not want to serve in the military because it was seen as a violation of human rights to force them into service when they were conscientious objectors. I had another question,
yeah. The other thing that you touched on, which I thought was really interesting, and I'd like you to talk about more, was about how this whole recruitment process affects the mentality of people living in El Salvador. I mean, when I came here to this session, I thought, well, the worst thing about this is that this is a country with its constant strife, and so people are always in danger of being involved in that aspect of military recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
But what I see now is, I mean, this is just a method of oppression and fear for all people all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I'll talk more about probably later in the week about negotiation processes, I mean, I see a very long road ahead, even if there's a ceasefire in itself. I mean, it's just, you've had a society that's been so armed for this long, and you have that many young men who've gone through that kind of process, what it does to your mentality. And every month or so, there's a case in El Salvador of an ex-military or a military person on leave who just goes berserk and thinks he's in battle and starts shooting and kills civilians or throws a hand grenade into somebody's house. It is. And what you say about fear, too, I mean, how do you get people to fight? Part of it's indoctrination, part of it's economics. I guess I didn't say too much more about that. I mean, they do get paid, although the military usually scrape, the officers scrape about half of what they get paid off of it. I mean, the corruption is incredible. But the fear is another. I mean, these are people who have been lived in fear all their lives and have been controlled, and all of a sudden there is a way in which they appeal to their sense of power. It's the first time in their lives they've had some sense of power to have a gun and be in the military. That's what those guys in the truck were feeling. Probably for the first time in their lives they had a sense of power, and it's an abusive kind of power.
And the age is quite young, basically, so they haven't gotten even the maturity aspect.
Supposed to be 18, but a lot of them are recruited at 15, 16, and 17. Now, if we appeal and say we have their birth certificate and really pressure them, we can usually get somebody out. But if nobody does that, they'll stay in. And a lot of times they won't even let a campesino woman come and talk to them. Because I'm a North American, I get to talk to people that a poor woman mother would. That's one of the, that's why they requested a North American to work with this program. But you haven't touched on anything yet.
I think I read you correctly when you say there's corruption, and also on the part of the Americans, right?
Well, if it's not direct, they certainly know that it happens, and they don't. And they don't
know
about it.
The people, well, such as the Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would think the Baptist Church is a powerful force in Congress in the United States. I mean, there's quite a few Baptists.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but there's Catholics and there'd be Lutherans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what kind of pressure has been placed on these senators to say, let's clean this mess up?
The churches in the United States have been working on issues in El Salvador for a long time, and I think that there certainly has been, I think there have been positive results from that. I think that some of the things that have happened in the last couple of years about changes in U.S. aid, at least withholding or conditionally holding withholding some of the aid, are a result of the kind of resistance going on in the United States and that kind of lobbying that takes place.
Well, I'm thinking of the representatives that are there that say this does not exist. Now, why are you in that position when you say that? Why do you agree with it?
Why do I agree with
it? I mean, the American representatives
who said it didn't exist
that are there, and they say this does not this bus situation does not exist, but we saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Now that person should know, if he's an American, that this does exist.
No,
and now, why does he keep in his job? Why can't there be pressure from above coming down to this person and say, now listen, you clean up your act?
Yeah. There is pressure. I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's pressure from churches, and churches are ecumenically organized in Washington with an office and specifically works on Central American stuff. But unfortunately, I'll talk more about this on Thursday, I think that the American people have lost, to a large degree, control over our government. And that the State Department receives that kind of pressure, and they do respond to it when it's absolutely necessary. But they really try as much as possible to get away with what they think is necessary to continue and to promote the foreign policy of the United States in El Salvador. And in my opinion, the foreign policy in the United States has very little to do with the interests of the people of El Salvador. And
if I were a senator and I knew that, I would certainly put pressure.
Some senators and representatives will, and unfortunately not enough.